This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 336, was recorded on August 11th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Nomura Quant Charlie McElligott returns as this week's feature interview guest. I'll ask Charlie whether there's another shoe to drop for this equity market, and if so, when it's coming. We'll also discuss rates and the gamma effects playing out this week in the market. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Betting on the Tail Move in Crude Oil.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. Obviously, the first hint that inflation may be cooling off a little bit, and the market took it very bullishly with a pretty good rip in the last couple of days. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, they say one data print doesn't make a trend, but boy, Patrick, just one not quite so bad as expected inflation print sure did ignite a rally in the stock market. So the logic seems to be that with less inflation to fight, the Fed will be able to pivot dovishly sooner, and that can only be good for stocks. Never mind all the negative economic data, the oncoming recession, and so on and so forth. So it seems like that's the predominant mindset. We'll see how long it lasts. I'm still skeptical of this rally, but frankly, I didn't think it could get this far, and it sure has. So I'm definitely the odd man out here.
Well, really, it's been this kind of risk on, risk off. And one of the things that tends to happen when the equities are going risk on is you have the dollar weakening. And certainly the Dixie has been pulling back here in the last week, particularly in reaction to the same numbers. Do you think that this has any meaningful shift in our bigger view?
Well, Patrick, we're starting to see signs of softening in this market. I don't know that it's time to panic yet. Still holding on to a 104 handle. So I think we'll have to see where this goes. I'm not persuaded that the trend has reversed. I think we're just seeing some consolidation. But let's see what happens in coming weeks.
All right. Well, let's touch on crude oil. I want to expand on this also in the post game. But crude oil had a pretty significant dip late last week, and really has stabilized and reversed. We're almost back to $95 here. What's your take on how this is playing out, and how did the inventories come in?
Well, EIA inventory came in with what would normally be a very bearish print, a build of 5.5 million barrels in the middle of August, which is usually peak demand season. Now, that was really only about 160,000 barrels built because the SPR provided most of that 5.5 million barrels. Actually, 5.3 million barrels came out of the SPR. That's where the oil was actually coming from. But still, even only 160,000 barrels, a build in August is still a build in August. So it was fairly bearish data. And I think what's interesting, as you just alluded, Patrick, is on the back of fairly bearish data, the market sold off, went straight down, just couldn't stay there. It feels like maybe the selling has exhausted. As we've tried to press further lows below that 200-day contract moving average, and it seems like we keep bouncing off of it, and as you say, very exuberantly now in the last couple of days, back up to almost $95, which is conveniently where the 200-day continuation moving average is located. So this is kind of the make-or-break point for the market. Getting back to inventory, Cushing, Oklahoma, building 723,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 5 million barrels. So there's your offset for the big build on crude oil. Distillates building, though, 2.2 million barrels. U.S. production picking up to a new cycle high of 12.2 million barrels, up 100,000 barrels from last week. Tape action was down on the inventory print, but only for a short while, and then it's been up ever since. So, Patrick, the 200-day moving average holding now as a effective support level, even on worsening inventory news. And that firmness we're seeing in the market is suggesting that maybe that really was the bottom and it's uphill from here. The jury is still out, though. This could be just a relief rally. If we can get above that 200-day continuation moving average at $95 and stay there, that really says maybe the bottom is in. And we're about to see the phenomenon that both Adam Rosenzweig and David Hay have talked about. Quite a few more people writing this week about David Hay's theory about more and more European consumers of gas switching to oil, and that switching of energy source from gas to oil might put the bottom on crude oil prices. So we'll see what happens. Maybe the bottom is in, but still, backwardation has completely collapsed out of the WTI crude oil market. Now, that normally would be a sign that the physical market just isn't tight anymore the way it was, or it could be an artificial flattening of the curve resulting from traders trying to front-run the government's purchase of long-dated contracts in order to replace the oil being drawn out of the SPR. Now, I'm still skeptical that they're really going to follow through and do that, but it seems like a lot of people are trying to front-run that trade, and that probably has contributed to the collapse in backwardation. Overall, Patrick, my outlook remains uber, uber bullish long-term, but with serious reservations about whether or not the bottom is in yet in the short term. We definitely have this collapse of backwardation signaling that the physical market tightness isn't there. We still have collapsing demand in the face of this oncoming recession. So maybe there's another wave down before this is over. Maybe it's over. I'm not sure. One way or another, I think we end the year higher than we are now.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold. Gold's been putting together several weeks of strength that basically has now seen us surpass 1800 and so far holding it. Now, I still think that there's room for retesting or short-term pullbacks, but certainly this is the first good wave of buying that we've seen in many months. Do you make anything out of that?
Well, Patrick, I've got my fingers and my toes crossed here. I would love to see this rally continue. I'd love to get above the 100-day moving average, particularly, which is up there at 1844 as we speak. But, Patrick, the problem that I have with this market is gold has disappointed us so many times when we thought the fundamentals were set up for a really big move up, and it didn't. And if I just look at the pattern of this sell-off over many months, it's been a series of ups and downs, and we've just had an up. Is it about to roll over? We're about at the right spot for that to happen. Let's see. If we can keep this rally going and get above the 100-day moving average, I'll be a lot more excited about it. Right now, I'm skeptical.
All right. Well, let's wrap up with touching on that 10-year Treasury yield, which still decisively below 3%, but lacking any meaningful moves in the last week. It really has been just in a tight 10-point range up and down. Do you think that there's another big yield move coming somewhere here?
Well, what I find interesting is that we just had this oh my gosh moment where the whole world decided that this inflation print was the most important data ever to come out, or whatever it was that ignited the rally in stocks over the last couple of days. And, you know, we really haven't seen a big move lower in yield, so it doesn't seem like they're celebrating inflation is over completely by buying bonds and expecting that there's no more inflation pressure on the upside of yields. So I'm not sure where this is headed, Patrick. We'll continue to watch it and see where it takes us.
This week's feature interview guest is Nomura's chief quant, Charlie McElligott. Eric, why did we get Charlie back on the show this week?
Well, it's been too long since we had Charlie on the show. He's one of our listeners' favorite guests. He's known for his graphs and charts. And I was really looking forward to having him diagnose what's going on with this equity market, why it's been so strong, whether it's going to roll over, and what comes next. So I think you'll find this interview very enlightening.
Well, Eric's interview with Charlie is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe.
Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Charlie McElligott, process and macro strategist at Nomura. Charlie has prepared a slide deck. For anyone who's not familiar with Charlie's work, he's famous for his graphs and charts, so you're not going to want to miss that slide deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads just above Charlie's picture. Charlie, it's great to have you back on the show. Before even diving into the slides, I want to just start at the really high-level big picture. Seems like there was lots of really good reasons for the stock market to be selling off through the middle of June as it was. All of a sudden, it changed direction. It's been rallying ever since, and most of us don't get it. It seems like the macro data is just getting worse. So does that mean this was just a dead cat bounce and we hit the 100-day moving average and it's all about to roll over? Or is there some big bullish catalyst that I've missed? What's going on here?
Yeah, so first of all, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for having me back. It's remarkable how many people I talk to around the street, you know, on the institutional side that say, you know, I first discovered you on Macro Voices. So, thank you. And obviously your platform is just wildly successful. You know, I think what happened over the course of the summer, and I think last time I was on, we spoke about what a clear trend market this had been. And that's why, you know, managed futures, CTA trend, is the far and away, you know, champion of the year-to-date kind of strategy performance. It's not based upon the traditional kind of bond stock correlation that so much of the kind of the modern investment asset allocation framework is. And it works as a it works beautifully in times of in a tail type of an environment. And that trend dynamic over the course of the year, which was very much premised upon that inflation overshoot, central banks forced to spastically tighten financial conditions theme was, you know, you were big shorts in bonds and in rates and in equities. And then on the long side, you were long US dollar, right? As the central bank had to impulse tighten because they were behind the curve. They miscategorized inflation as transitory and it became something that's structurally persistent. And then also too, you were long commodities as your kind of inflation hedge. In June, I would say, is when that CPI shock, what was one of the most recent CPI shocks, another upside beat there. I think it saw the mentality from the market shift to, oh, dear Lord, we don't have our arms around this situation anymore. We do not know where this is going. High inflation tends to mean trending inflation. We've lost the ability to forecast this. And where we're going, you know, to borrow a line from Back to the Future, where we're going, there are no roads. The mentality shifted from that previous focus on inflation upside risk now to growth downside risks, which then kicked off a bunch of second order impact. And then that growth downside risk became this, you know, this sudden corroboration with a lot of growth data, as well as things that we mentioned last time we spoke, which were, you know, trends in the market that were telling you that markets were pricing increased probability of recession. You know, this immediately created something that looked like equivalent to a dovish Fed pivot. And you had this impulse easing in financial conditions. And I can go on from there as to, you know, those second order impacts, what that then created, and saw this kind of counterintuitive rally, in equities that seemingly, as you said, from a top-down perspective, had this perfect next leg down kind of story to go that then went completely awry over the last month and a half.
It seems to me that a big part of this picture is a whole lot of people have an embedded expectation that what's coming, it's almost like it's an immutable law of science that there has to be a deeply dovish Fed pivot, and it has to be coming soon, and the only thing to be figured out is when it's coming. Almost nobody seems to question whether it's coming. Does there really have to be a dovish pivot, or is there too much assumption built into those expectations?
Well, we've certainly learned that, you know, from the incredibly overly simplistic view as per the kind of 15-year back test, let's say, and honestly, you know, to be fair, any tightening cycle, but much more so since we became, you know, the Fed became this interventionist activist body in the, you know, the post financial crisis period, is that, you know, liquidity on means, you know, long risk assets, long duration, long speculative. And obviously, in periods of tightening, you get the opposite. And the fact of the matter was that once the Fed capitulated to the markets this time around in a tightening fashion, saying that we completely missed the plot on inflation and we don't know where we're going with regards to, we don't know where the neutral rate is. We don't know where we're going with regards to running restrictive. And the inflation data continued to beat to the upside. It rightfully created a real panic that was then, you know, further amplified by the fact that policy is lagging. Policy accumulates; it's nonlinear, and you started seeing a very, you know, sudden softening in survey data, very sudden softening in housing. You know, stuff that's very credit sensitive started going wrong way, and that allowed the market to pull forward this former conditioning that's frankly been established over, you know, certainly over the last decade plus in the post-crisis period, but frankly over a 30-year bond bull market, which is that, okay, growth slowdown, growth scare, Fed can, you know, begin cutting rates down to zero. And in the more recent period, Fed can begin large-scale asset purchases, i.e. QE. The fact of the matter is we haven't had one of these growth scares when we have what has now been dictated by the Fed as the sole mandate, that being inflation. We haven't had an environment with 9.1% inflation where labor is running at a 3.5 U rate and Atlanta Fed wage growth is at all-time highs. That allows that, or that disallows that prior muscle memory, that prior conditioning that we can simply go back to an era of Fed pivot, that definition being cut rates to zero, buy assets, that we can't go back to that, at least in any time in the realistic near future. And that discussion, as far as the speed and the definition of what is an ease, right? Is an ease going to be to the market the move from 75 to 50? Is the ease going to be saying that we are at our terminal rate, we're 50 bips through our terminal rate, and we stop and pause? You know, I think that in my mind is why we're still going to be, and I've said this for, you know, the last month and a half, why we're going to be stuck in kind of this uncomfortable range trade, because that old mentality, that old idea that you can shift back into QE, you can shift back into zero interest rate policy is not an option right now. So instead, the best that you're going to get probably for the next year plus is after we get a few more hikes in, and after we do a lot more quantitative tightening, is that we just slow tightening early. You know, we slow the balance sheet runoff and that we don't hike rates. And frankly, when you consider how much tightening has happened in the background, both with the policy rate staying higher and the balance sheet runoff, that's not a really great environment for risk.
Yeah, I notice on page one of your slide deck, you say one of the best trades that you see is fading expectations of a spring of 23 rate cut, a Fed rate cut. It seems to me if what you're saying is you don't think the Fed is really going to pivot dovishly as everybody expects, is the best trade really fading that, or is the best trade anticipating what that's going to mean for the stock market, which I would think would be a lot of down from here?
So the trade that you're talking about is something that I've been speaking to clients for the last, you know, the last 3 weeks, I guess, since I got back from summer family holiday. And that was this idea that you had almost an entire Fed cut priced in the Eurodollar curve, Eurodollars are just, you know, interest rate futures, Eurodollar futures, not the currency. And, you know, this is shown in EDZ2, which is the December 22 contract, and EDH3, which is the March 23 contract, meaning it's covering that period of time between December to March of next year. In my view, it was for those very reasons that you're dealing with, you know, 9%+ headline, with this impossibly strong labor market, with this impossibly strong wage growth, that there is no way, shape, or form that the Fed is going to be able to signal anything close to a dovish pivot at that time, because financial conditions will ease too much, which ultimately is counterproductive for what the Fed is trying to do. And the Fed is trying to destroy demand because that's the only lever they can pull. They can't address the supply side issues with regards to, you know, energy, with regards to refinery capacity, with regards to very large container ships, with regards to U.S. housing supply, with regards to rent options. All of these things are part of this backdrop that are completely tying their hands. So the idea was, you know, just a few weeks ago, that Eurodollar curve was implying 25 bips of cut. And I said, there's no chance. That has to go to zero. So, you know, you put on a steepener here. Well, in the span, frankly, of the last week, this thing has gone almost to zero. And that is because this non-farm payroll last week and the average hourly earnings upside surprises justified the Fed's aggressive hawkish messaging that they had to kick off a week and a half ago, because that impulse easing of financial conditions. And when we're talking about financial conditions, like, we're talking about things that, you know, kind of increase or decrease kind of the, you know, the access to money, the cost of money. I mean, that's everything from equities volatility to credit spreads to the level of the US dollar to real yields, right? Nominal yields, less inflation. And all of those things over the course of this risk on rally, in the course of this duration rally, as the market began to then get more concerned about an imminent recession kind of starting in mid-June, from the implications of all this hiking, was that you would then see, you know, this pivot back into this early Fed cutting cycle. And I just said that's a non-starter. Accordingly, that EDZ2, EDH3 spread has almost gone back to zero, and that trade has worked. What the trick here is that the market is still pricing in now somewhere close to 60 bips of cuts just later in next year. So if you go from EDH3, which is the, you know, that same kind of March point, to EDZ3, which is December of 23, you're 60 bips inverted, which is telling you that, you know, 60 bips worth of Fed cuts. And what that number has done has really grown, because the market is telling you the more hawkish you are now, the more you slam on the brakes now, the higher that the terminal rate gets, the more that, you know, September goes from 50 to 75, or February becomes a hike when people thought December would be the last hike, that's going to receive an equal and opposite impulse easing, because you're going to slam the brakes on the economy just in that typical lagging policy fashion. So you've really just shifted the time horizon into, you know, all of this big tightening and staying tighter for longer, staying higher for longer, staying restrictive for longer because of the inflation problem, now is going to create down the road what the market is telling you is a much bigger impulse easing on the way out of this thing. And that's why the market's telling, yeah, we're going to get somewhere between, you know, a 50 bips first cut and a 75 bips first cut. And they're still, frankly, targeting that for the end of 2023.
And what's your outlook? Can that happen by the end of 2023? It seems like inflation's a real deal here.
Inflation is a real deal. And this is something that I've spoken with markets groups, with central banks around the world in recent weeks and months, is that anytime, and this is part, this goes to that idea of how reflexive the market is, right? The market, you know, reacts to something in real time, pulls forward kind of a future event, you know, begins to price in a future event before you even get there. You know, I've spoken about the idea of kind of anticipating the anticipators, and, you know, a lot of strategies kind of do something similar. Well, in this case, the market preemptively, too early, priced in easing start of next year. I don't think that's possible. We've since zapped that out of existence in that Q1 window, right? There's no more cuts priced in for Q1. I think what you're going to see, and this is kind of the way I'm sequencing this right now, is that we all know that the data is beginning to soften. We know that inflation expectations, which are critical for the Fed, are beginning to soften, which is largely a function of gas prices going down over the last month and a half as we've, you know, blown out half of the SPR. The fact of the matter is that accounts for a lot of the, you know, some of that, you know, kind of headline type of relief and some of that inflation expectations relief that the consumer has felt. And frankly, why you're seeing, you know, Democratic numbers begin to pick up again and actually take the Senate back and some of the gambling markets, simply as it's almost a pure input of gasoline prices. But I think the trick is this. I see no scope in a one-year time horizon. It's almost mathematically impossible to get down to 2% target without running multiple months in a row of negative inflation. And I think what the reality is this. How quickly can we move down to that 6% inflation, 5% inflation, 4% inflation that will allow the Fed over that period of time, it buys them time to kind of move the goalposts, shift the message. By that time, we will have seen job loss. Job loss is something that the Fed tries not to talk about, but that is what they are trying to do with regards to demand destruction. Because again, demand is the only lever they can pull here. They can't address the supply issues. So the fact is they got to slam on the brakes. They're going to slam on the brakes longer than people currently imagine. And you're going to get a bigger ease when you get out of this thing. I think the next trick becomes maybe it's sometime late this Q4. Maybe it's Q1 of next year. I think people are going to, you know, get some feel-good relief in the next few months. They're going to see some of this data begin to soften and confirm that, you know, peak inflation is behind us. But at some point in Q4 or Q1, they're going to look around and say, we're not going to get back down below 4%, maybe ever again, because of some of these structural issues. And you know, that goes with some of the inventory clearing issues that we've seen that were part of the problem with Walmart, part of the problem with Target, part of the problem with a lot of the earnings prints that haven't gone well are inventory issues. That's the bullwhip effect of that COVID, you know, rush to preload and bring on all this capacity. And then things normalize and people are shocked that you can't sell, you know, NBA champion hats from the 2019 year and in 2022 because that stuff just gets off a container ship from China. So like, I think in this case, you're going to have another shoe to drop with this idea that, oh, snap, we maybe have stopped hiking at a point, but inflation is still sitting 4.5%, something like that, at some point, start of next year. Now what? Because you're definitely going to have some accumulated slowing down in the growth data. And that's when I think people are going to get pretty uncomfortable again with where we go now. And at that point, you have to be on the lookout for the Fed to kind of move the goalposts on you, whether that is begin talking about growth and labor. You know, obviously growth is not a mandate, but full employment is, whether that's about moving the inflation target, which is a non-zero probability. All of those things will be in play next year, particularly if financial conditions, you know, do keep tightening and you do see job loss piling up and the political pressure will be, you know, pretty severe on them. Right now, ironically, the market just caught a lot of slack from that non-farm payroll number and the AHE, because I'm actually hearing some equity bulls beginning to rationalize it like this. We're seeing prices contract, right? The commodities roll over, the energy roll over, the gas roll over. Inflation expectations are softening. You're seeing that in regional Fed data. You're seeing that in University of Michigan. But then you have this big labor market strength, and you're seeing through earnings so far that companies still have pricing power. We talk about the low-end consumer who's struggled, and you've seen that with Target and Walmart, et cetera. But the middle class and the upper class, for now, because of the relative, you know, strength of the balance sheet, they've been able to digest the price increases. So what that gives you, it buys time. It gives you more rope to digest the forward state of the lagging impact of, you know, the tightening. And that will ultimately get you then through that dangerous period and get you closer to that ultimate dovish Fed pivot that gives you, as I said, what the market is pricing in to be somewhere between a 50 bips and a 75 bips cut right out of the gates. So that's how people are trying to get comfortable taking their net exposure back up, taking up their equities allocations, which have been low single digit percentile over the past year, you know, after being kind of varred down, grossed down over the course of, you know, frankly, since November of last year. That's the way I think people are, you know, are trying to get comfortable with this. It's just in my mind, I think there's going to be one more hiccup, whether that's Q3 earnings that actually do begin to roll over on account of the implications of the top-down slowdown, or if it's in my mind, it's about, you know, you kind of hit this sticky point in inflation where we're stuck between 4% and 5% as we turn into next year, and the market realizes we're out of gas, and the Fed is really in a bind there because it's persistently higher, and we're not going to get it back down to target.
As we stand right here in the middle of August, we had a pretty brisk rally up to the 100-day moving average. Then for the last week or so, it's kind of been consolidating just above it. Is this where the next shoe's getting ready to drop and we're about to head back down?
So here's the deal on the kind of the setup. You know, I'll go qualitatively and then I'll go a little more quantitative as far as some of the flows behind this rally that, you know, look, we know that people were, you know, extensively bearishly positioned and that sentiment was very bearish. And the thesis was kind of going into this earnings period that earnings were going to be the next shoe to drop for equities. All of the equity sell-off year to date, let's say the first 6 months of the year, was on the multiple, right? On the interest rate move, on the Fed being behind the curve, the Fed having to spastically hike and tighten financial conditions. And then you got the multiple contraction. So almost all of the move was on the multiple side. It was on the interest rate side. It was not on the earnings side. Earnings for equities from the bottoms up were actually going higher over the course of the year. That sounds counterintuitive, which is why so many from the macro community, as we were heading into this, you know, kind of current, although wrapping up now, earnings period, that they thought that that was said next shoe to drop for equities and for broad risk assets. You were finally going to get the earnings, the E side, to go lower, you know, in light of kind of corroborating the top-down growth slowdown that you were seeing in macroeconomic data. What ended up happening, however, was that expectations were so horrifically bad for earnings. People were so positioned short, were so historically underweighted, were so high cash. CTA trend was so grossed up in their shorts. You know, vol control was completely deallocated, that prints came in less bad. And the fact is, earnings have continued to go higher. Almost 20% of the overall S&P earnings profile has been driven by energy. Makes sense. Think, look at what crude has done, right? Look at what nat gas has done. But it's in other sectors too, right? It's in everything from autos to semiconductors, right? Those are also commodities. And the price gains in this earnings period, what we saw, the price gains more than offset the macro volume slowdown, right? The sales slowdown. And that caught people flat. So there was also simultaneously a view in the market that with regards to that next shoe to drop being earnings, a couple of prominent strategists in the street who really had the call from a macro level, you know, a pretty right call. But they were kind of both, you know, two guys in particular were both really kind of focusing on this potential scenario where S&P was going to get that kind of clearing event, say down to like 3,000 or 3,400, at which case you could look at, you know, historical levels, historical multiples, historic earnings, and make a justification where you could say, that's a dip I want to buy. So everybody thought earnings were going to be the shoe to drop. You were going to get this cleanse. You're going to get this purge. That was going to be the time to buy. It was going to happen at the same time that growth was slowing, that the Fed would be nearing a pivot. And, you know, you ride off in the sunset, you buy that dip, and there we go. Problem was, the dip never came. You know, you remember that week of, you know, some of those really heavy mega cap tech earnings, and they just weren't bad enough relative to expectations. The market began to rally, and as spot began to rally, and we got through the big earnings events, which are volatility catalysts, vol started coming lower. And as that those really grossed up shorts, right, from the CTA side, you know, price, their time series began to get away from them. Signals began to flip in the very shorter dated stuff. They began to cover. And that helped spot, you know, index move higher. Vol began coming lower too. Some of that short gamma, as vol rolled over, some of that short gamma that dealers were dealing with got longer. They had less of a short gamma problem. You were getting less violent range trades. Vol control, which was coming off of a 3-month realized volatility period that was sitting up at 100th percentile, mathematically was going to move lower simply because those high stress days of the late April, early May period were going to move out of that 3-month horizon. And that alone was going to lead to mechanical reallocation. And, you know, look, over the course of the past month, CTA alone has been something close to $70 billion of almost predominantly covering flow. But that aggregate position in our CTA model is now basically back to flat. You know, there are some components that are small long, but they're relatively de minimis. Vol control has bought, you know, so almost, you know, $12 billion or something over that same period and has another kind of $20 to $30 billion over the next month. And then this all goes down to, as you can kind of see on slides 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, some outrageously underweight short position. You know, slide 5 is long short hedge fund beta to S&P. As of last week, it was 9th percentile going back to 2003. Just completely not there for an equities rally. The next slide on page 6, macro fund beta, 18th percentile. Same deal. Not there for a rally. They were bared up, as I said, on the earnings story, on that anticipated cleanse purge that you were going to get that never came. And now people are in a position, have been in a position in recent weeks to, you know, forced to become buyers higher. And then, you know, page 7, you see that, you know, it just shows the correlation of macro hedge fund to S&P, frankly, at a level seen, you know, only two other times in the past decade. And then, you know, just from an overall kind of asset managers versus leverage perspective, like nobody was there. Asset manager S&P futures positioning, you know, has recovered up to 21st percentile, whereas levered, right, so that, you know, hedge fund universe is 1.9 percentile. And that's actually 0.1 percentile. That's how short they are going back to 2006. So in page 9, it just shows the kind of U.S. equities futures aggregate positioning across, you know, for asset managers, for levered, and for non-coms across S&P, NASDAQ, and Russell. This is a rally that nobody was there for. Once the systematics, you know, just for mechanical purposes, for price purposes, for vol crunch purposes, began to run with the ball, they just left the fundamental kind of macro bears in the dust. And it's been a really painful trade higher, even though earnings by no means were fantastic. They were just less bad than expectations.
Charlie, let's move on and talk about volatility specifically. We had you in the show a few years ago. We talked about the Volmageddon event back in 2018. We've got situations now where in energy particularly, there are entire countries that are being brought to their knees by volatility in energy prices, which frankly, I think is set to continue to the upside, maybe not till we get through this recession, but at some point it's going to get really interesting. What does all of this mean systemically in terms of how the street is processing all this increase of volatility?
What's, you know, the kind of the largest talking point in my world for the last, you know, few months is that, you know, again, from that same macro top down, very bearish outlook, whether it's global growth, whether it's persistently sticky higher inflation, whether it's geopolitics, whether it's, you know, the energy induced recession risk in Europe or our own, you know, kind of tightening into a slowdown recession risk in the United States, is that vol has just continued to bleed. And I think what's critical here, there's a bunch of different inputs. A couple I think are particularly relevant for the audience. And the first is that we were coming from a really high place, right? Just you know, about 2 weeks ago, you know, 3-month realized volatility in the S&P was 100th percentile, right, over the last year, just meaning as far as the rank of all of the volatility events over the past year, that 3-month window was sitting at the highs, you know, at the money implied vols, for the large part, the most last few months had been sitting kind of in the 90 percentiles. You know, vol was high for a reason. this was kind of one of those term that I've used before as it pertained to the Volmageddon stuff back in the days. This was a neon swan, right? We knew that the incredible cacophony of idiosyncratic events as it related to once in a lifetime COVID response with monetary policy, with fiscal policy, with cash drops, with the bullwhip that incurred, with already a broken supply chain issues, with Ukraine, Russia, and the impact that had on energy in a world where ESG was a religion, and the underinvestment there, where there simply wasn't the infrastructure to get the stuff out. It was really a remarkable set of scenarios, and you had this just tectonic shift with regards to an inflation landscape, which for the last 20 plus years, by and large, had been written off for dead, right? We've talked previously about, the three Ds of debt, demographics, and tech disruption all being disinflationary, structurally, secularly disinflationary. Well, it took these, multiple acts of God all happening kind of the same time, and then the tiebreaker of unprecedented fiscal stimulus to catch a world who is de facto short inflation flat, and everybody got stopped out in their flat in inflation trades. And that's why vol was high. And we knew that was going to create a spastic global central bank community that was going to have to, hike, have to unwind balance sheet, have to do all these things that markets don't like. Well, we got that. We got that. And the fact of the matter is, if you go to page 12, you'll see what that led to. When we got that market shock starting in November, which was the month, it was like, I think at the time, it was like the sixth consecutive CPI upside surprise. The market started getting the joke that the Fed was behind, the transitory was a scam. And by the time December Fed meeting came around, the Fed too acknowledged it. So in November of last year, you had crypto start breaking down. You had all of those Cathie Wood, ARK, unprofitable tech, perpetual hyper growth, 100 times high multiple stocks start getting wrecked. And you started seeing these momentum shocks for all these trades that benefited from, there were duration proxies, right? They benefited from low interest rates and large scale asset purchases. Well, they got all stopped out. So on page 12, you'll see that we've been sitting in the midst of, a 6 to 9 month rolling gross down, right? People, because of the volatility, because of the, spot sell-off, people have had to sell longs and either press shorts, to make money on the downside, or cover their shorts and get out of the market. And what you see there is that, skew or put skew, which is just looking at like relative demand, skew, relative demand of a put versus a call. So relative demand for downside versus upside, or, put skew is the fact of like, kind of like the idea of wingy skew, like something in this case, like a crashy put preference for, something that's really targeting a big market move. Well, you can see there in that 5-year percentile column, low single digits. There's no demand for downside. And it's been like this for months. There's no demand for downside because clients don't have any exposure to hedge anymore, right? Conversely, you see call skew there, which is kind of right tail. Everybody was mortified after they slashed their positioning over the course of Q1 into Q2, and you kept getting more inflation upside surprises, and you saw the Fed keep forward guiding us wrong way and having to hike by more. The June meeting was peak of absurdity, where they guided us to 50 bips at the next two meetings, and then, the Fed had to leak 3 days before the actual June meeting that they were going to hike by 75. Just a clown show. Everybody was mortified about missing a dovish pivot, about missing the rally because they didn't have any exposure on. So that's part of this deal where like downside began to bleed because you just didn't need any exposure on. And, and all frankly against a very credible and rational macro bear case, which, created this, perversely, all of the fear was about the right tail. All of the fear was about missing upside. On slide 10 and 11, it just goes to show you how much vol continues to come off now from what was just really high up until recently, really high absolute levels of vol. That's the one past month snapshot as of this Monday. just to show you collectively what's happened across different equities classes internationally, different kind of sectors and assets. It's just been a one-way bleed in volatility. And page 11, frankly, refers to some of the stuff that I was talking about with regards to vol control funds. You know, a very simple vol control model is just looking at the absolute higher of 1 month realized versus 3 month realized. In this case, that's the orange line, 3 month realized. Where, as I said, just 2 weeks ago, that was 100th percentile. But in that 3 month window, all of that volatility of like the panicky days of April and May starts dropping out. That number is just going to crater lower. It's now, as of today, somewhere in the mid 70 percentile. And perversely, that leads to more buying. Ultimately, you saw kind of similar effects here as far as the spillovers were that, you know, people were holding downside or were holding hedges, and the hedges weren't materializing because this was just a bleeding exposure let out. You know, it was a bleeding gross down. So even people that had on a crashy downside hedges, they weren't getting paid out for that stuff. And, you know, at that point, it's like the War Games quote, you know, the only way to win the game is to not play. And you know, these hedges started getting purged. And lo and behold, you know, you've had this massive, massive, massive amount of covering of those hedges that dealers had on. So, you know, page 17, that world that was positioned for kind of crash, that world that was positioned for recession, that world that was positioned for all of these bad outcomes. What happens when a dealer is short downside to clients is they have to be, short futures against that. And what's happened now as not only have puts been sold, right? Because the market's getting away from you. So those puts are losing value. Those puts are decaying. But people have also, to the point I made about call skew, been buying upside because they're missing the rally. You know, they're chasing into upside, and both selling puts and buying calls creates positive delta, meaning dealers have to go out and buy futures to hedge. So you can see there on slide 17, just across, you know, S&P, across SPY, across Q, and across IWM, just over the past month alone, you've had almost $600 billion of implied futures to buy from dealers just in the option space, looking at, you know, the U.S. options, equity options landscape. It's just absolutely massive how much force that generates, which is why, you know, I always say dealer hedging and dealer gamma are the most important flows in the market.
Charlie, on that note, let's hit the sequence of slides you've got beginning on page 19, because when you say that gamma is the most important flow in the market, not everybody completely understands what you're talking about. Please explain this so that everyone can understand. Why is gamma the most important flow? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with, you know, certainly in the post-crisis world, this idea that volatility or selling volatility in that sense was, you know, became an asset class, that it became a yield enhancement strategy, the growth of option strategies, the popularity of options now to this day, you know, the deployment now, it's not just an institutional tool, it's a retail tool as we see on a daily basis with the meme stocks. And the fact that these are so popular now, there are now expirations every day of the week. And that creates incredible convexity in the market, where there's just a constant stream of forced hedging around these positions. And when we are in a, you know, when dealers are in a long gamma regime where there are long optionality because clients have sold them options, basically, or when we're in a short gamma regime, particularly, you know, when there's grab or, you know, a fearful kind of market trade and, you know, dealers are short downside, they're short hedges to clients, you get a short gamma environment. And short gamma is, you know, the boogeyman for the last few years, but rightfully so, sitting on, you know, one of the biggest vol desks, you know, in the world. The magnitude of the flows that go through as far as needing to, you know, hedge on the fly throughout the course of the day with, you know, buying or selling a yard, you know, $1 billion worth of futures or 200 million here, 500 million there, at times, and certainly as it relates to those kind of end of day periods where a lot of this hedging occurs, you know, leave the general audience kind of scratching their heads, like, what is that all about? And I think now it's become well socialized, well democratized in the era of, you know, the socialization of trading and Robin Hood and things like that, you know, there's common sources of information now that aren't just for institutions. But what's been very important over the past month of this rally, you know, where spot began to move higher, you didn't get the earnings disaster, positioning was short, sentiment was short, CTAs were very short, you began to see short-term windows actually flip long, they began to cover, and as spot rallied, vol softened. Vol softening gets dealers back some of that short gamma, and kind of mechanically, they get longer gamma. And when you're in a long gamma regime, it's stabilizing. Long gamma is liquidity adding, like long gamma injects liquidity into the market. So a big part of like market stress in periods of, you know, in periods of crisis is the fact that dealers typically at that point, you know, there's a grab into protection. There's a grab into hedges. Dealers are short gamma. So dealers or market makers, instead of contributing liquidity, right, where they can step in and offer, you know, futures, they can sell futures into a market that's ripping higher, right, where it's kind of countercyclical, where they can, if a market that's collapsing, they can step in and buy, right? That would be a long gamma regime. It's stabilizing. It compresses ranges. It suppresses intraday swings. That's the world that we lived in, frankly, in the post-financial crisis period. Really, you know, with the exception of a few short months here and there, mostly around, you know, central bank taper tantrums, that was the world that we lived in, where volatility was sold as an asset class. You know, it was a yield enhancement strategy, not just for, you know, sophisticated hedge funds, for ma and pa investors. And that long gamma regime stabilized markets. Well, in a world of, you know, fear of central bank tightening us into a recession, a world, you know, of energy shortages and land wars in continental Europe, et cetera, you know, this short gamma world that we're in, it feeds into volatility. Dealers have to sell the lower we go to stay hedged, they have to buy the higher we go to stay hedged. And that's it's a momentum force. It's an accelerant force, and it creates those much wider, much more dangerous moves. So in the context that the last, say, 6 weeks of rally has gotten us back into a long gamma regime, as you can see kind of on pages 19, 20, and 21, that is relative good news. And, you know, for what it's worth, these slides were made a day ago. So, you know, they're relatively constant, even though the market is selling off a touch. But, you know, we are now, and this is why gamma is so important, Qs, triple Q, it's the, you know, the ETF for NASDAQ, very, very deep liquid market. Qs are now nearing that point of gamma flip, where you go from that stabilizing long gamma into that destabilizing accelerant flow feeds into momentum short gamma regime, you know, because of where they are versus spot. And why this matters on page 22, 23, and 24, you can see in just this most recent period, kind of going back to November of last year, that red box on the bottom, we've been really immersed in a persistent short gamma regime. And what that red arrow on top captures with those white lines above it, that's just the five-day absolute return. So you basically, it's capturing that exact phenomenon. When you're in a short gamma regime, you get bigger ranges. You get bigger ranges because options dealer flows feed into moves. They don't offset moves. Recently, you see that small green box just over the last few weeks, on the bottom there, that we move back into a long gamma regime in S&P. And lo and behold, those ranges get compressed because long gamma tends to buy weakness and sell strength. That's, you know, the same thing on 23. You know, I mean, the first slide was 1 day high low range. Next day was a 5 day absolute, you know, return range. I think 24 best captures this, and I think it's really interesting. Basically, if you just look where if you're starting the day in a negative gamma regime or a positive gamma regime, you can see that absolute, the 1 day absolute return range. In a negative gamma regime, it's almost, you know, it's over almost two and a half times that of a positive gamma regime. You have bigger ranges, you have higher VIX. And that's what you see in that first plot there. In long gamma regime, the distribution is clustered. It's compressed, right? Volatility, lower VIX, smaller absolute 1 day range. In a short gamma, a negative gamma regime, those are the red dots all over the place. both higher and lower, right? With regards to, you know, but outlier VIX moves, outlier absolute ranges. The cut on the right is just another way to express that, you know, VIX versus absolute 1 day moves. Negative gamma, it takes off the insulation. And that's a real problem. And that's part of this backdrop that I'm looking at right now, which is that, you know, as I said, the dealer CTA trades, all of those winning trades, why CTAs were up 35% earlier in the year over this kind of stop out, and they were monetizing winning trades over the course of the year. But over this stop out of the last month and a half, you know, the fixed income short is now clean. That positioning can reset in either direction. Right now, the Fed told you we're going to have to be hawkish and run more restrictive with rates higher for longer. So you're seeing fixed income sell off again, and you're actually beginning to get away from that recession trade because the Fed is telling you we're trying to induce a recession, you fools. That's the point. We're trying to create job loss because that's the only way you can actually clobber demand to such an extent that it could actually have an input, an inflation, a negative inflation input. You know, the equity is short. Has been stopped out, as I said, 70 billion type magnitude over the last 1 month. And what that's created on page 25 is that's just our estimate across all of our asset buckets in the CTA model. This trade has been stopped out. All that first 6 months of the year, the trend trades, the long commodities, long dollar, short equities, short bonds, almost every single one of those trades is now kind of in a net place. And that chart shows you that the gross exposure, the aggregate position size across all of that is as low as we've been in 11 years, 0.1 percentile. For me, that's a signal that now this trade can potentially, you know, go to a new place. It's kind of like this, look, we're clean. We got the stop out. Now some of those flows that have been squeezing, like say, for instance, the equities market higher. Now, yes, absolutely. CTAs could now go from flat to outright long, but that's higher. That's 5 to 10% higher by current levels in the market right now. We're not there. So CTAs are less of a buying story. This at vol control is still there. But, you know, bonds can sell off again. And if bonds can sell off again because the Fed is telling you so and into this critical CPI number tomorrow, which might still just be a little too sticky for that, you know, for that segment of the market, which continues to pray for an early dovish pivot as we get, you know, any sort of resumption of rate volatility, I do think that they, you know, the equities market in this recent rally, it probably has some weak hands. We've seen how trashy it has been, but, you know, loaded, popular, crowded shorts by meme stocks, you know, by low quality, no earnings, you know, types of companies, highly speculative stuff like SPACs. You can see all that stuff on page 28. You can see the call volumes trading in meme stocks on page 29. You know, all of these things are, you know, destabilizing. You know, typically, when you see vol move higher, and like we did, you know, the last few days, you've seen spot up, vol up, typically a signal for coming volatility. You know, in this case, it's instable, irrational behavior by, you know, kind of this Wall Street Bets crowd or even institutional traders looking at high short interest names buying 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% out of the money upside calls to try to create these gamma squeezes. Well, if the price does melt up to there because dealers have to hedge and buy futures or buy stock on the way up to hedge what they're short on the upside, you can just as quickly melt down and turn lower on the way down. You tend to see those spot up, vol up rallies collapse under the own weight of the implied expectations. And that's what we saw certainly multiple times with the memes. So there's just a lot of stuff going on in the market right now, whether it's the meme stock, you know, irrational exuberance stuff, whether it's this speculative, very short-led nature of this rally, whether it's the systematic flows that I spoke to that have been so much of the buying, particularly with the equities stuff, that are now, you know, kind of tuckering out, and you're now back to flat against this idea that I do think that inflation is going to stay sticky higher for longer, you know, where you can get down to 6, 5, 4%, but you're not going to be able to get to 2%. And that market that has been trained into thinking that the first sign of a growth panic, the Fed can ease, the Fed can buy assets, you know, is set up for a disappointment and could be caught flat-footed again. And I think there probably is one more downtrade before we can really get that, you know, kind of full capitulation and get kind of, you know, full tilt, all in constructive at some point next year.
Well, Charlie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. As many of our listeners know, one of the best pieces of institutional research that crosses my desk every day is your daily letter that is available to institutional clients of Nomura. So if you are an institutional investor listening to this program, reach out to your Nomura rep and be sure to get on the distribution list for Charlie's excellent letter. Unfortunately, it's not available to our retail audience. Charlie is not in charge of making the compliance rules. Please don't blame him. He just has to follow them. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Charlie back on the show. One of the interesting takeaways I had, which was when he was talking about the S&P skew trends for those six-month percentiles, it's basically highlighting that essentially the need for ensuring downside risk in the market seems to have weaned quite a bit. And in fact, that where almost all the action is traders grabbing at those call options, the FOMO, basically fear of missing this rally. And really kind of it makes me step back and think about the sentiment of where we are. I mean, are we already getting into that stage where everyone is sure that some sort of a short-term low is in and the fear of missing out is really now the dominant emotional driver? What's your take on that?
Well, Patrick, that's the $64 million question. The thing I just can't help but keep doing is looking at the tape, looking at the actual chart here. It looks really bullish. And frankly, I don't understand why. I think it should be very bearish. But if I look at how easily the market has broken through significant technical resistance levels, how it's accelerated its move above key resistance levels, it all looks to me like a very healthy bear market at a time when I think it's overdue that it should have rolled over. So I don't know what to make of it. I don't mind admitting that. And I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But Patrick, I want to move on now to our post-game chart book, which you've titled Betting on the Tail Move in Oil. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, before we dive into crude oil, we've got the S&P 500 chart on page 2. What's going on here?
Well, you know what? We always want to have a quick look at this chart, and you were specifically referencing that very bullish price action that we've been seeing. And there's no denying that the last month that has more or less seen a 500-point advance in the S&P has been a very bullish advance. The one thing I reflect upon is that during bear markets, bear market rallies are always the most violent and the most convincing. You know, you take several of the prior bear markets, a 20% rally off of their oversold levels is actually incredibly common. And we're just approaching, you know, 15 to 20% off of that recent low. I think it's very premature to be already suggesting that this is a bull market just because we've bounced after a 6-month bear. I think that there's a lot more price action development that we need to see before I flip to the other side. And in fact, as we go into the post-Labor Day period and the market gets active again, and I think there's lots of potential headwinds that could cause this market to come right back down. The one thing though, Eric, that I wanted to move on to page three is just the volatility. And Charlie really nailed this. I mean, ultimately, what we saw was just a perfect oversold condition. You know, CTAs were short. You know, volatility targeting asset managers basically were massively underinvested. All these different things were set up, including dealers being short all sorts of contracts to hedge out their books. Suddenly, you had an unwinding, and it created this reverse impulse. And so as volatility collapsed here on the VIX, that has been driving a lot of buying. But we are now approaching the bottom end of the range of the post-COVID period. I mean, the VIX is more or less, I mean, at some points we've seen it come down to like the 15 level. But this 18 to 20 range where we're slowly approaching has been a bottom end of this range that could be where volatility settles in. The interesting thing about that is that it's just that volatility will no longer be a tailwind, but rather become more neutral. And when you already have CTA flips and gamma neutralizing, the bigger question is what will drive any further buying in the markets. And this is where I think that the market could run out of gas. And that doesn't mean it has to be immediately some bearish decline, but rather simply that the market starts to consolidate at these levels. And that'll be one of the more interesting things to see whether that happens throughout the remainder of the summer.
Well, Patrick, moving on to page four, we've got crude oil futures definitely in a strong downtrend, or at least has been. Maybe we're seeing some signs of bottoming here. Maybe not. What do you think?
Well, listen, we have guest after guest come on that really suggests that there's a secular trend and the conditions there for oil prices to be considerably higher over the long term. So what we're in the midst of is a short-term correction from quite an overbought condition where sentiment was so decisively bullish that we were due for some sort of a pullback. So now that we've pulled back, I think the theme that me and you discussed about talking about was, well, how do you put on during this kind of a period some right tail trades that just in case crude oil goes ripping higher and let's say by year's end doubles in value, how do you put on some low cost, low risk trades that could have a big payoff if it works? So I want to spend some time talking about some potential ways to put on trades like this. And I think technically, when we're just looking at charts on page 4 and 5, the observation there is simply there has been a very distinct and deep retracement of the prior advance. And we're just going to have to wait to see when the bulls re-engage a new bullish breakout. Obviously, I think the easiest thing to do is simply use the 100 level as a pivot. I mean, if we are clearing $100 on the upside on crude, then it's really going to start demonstrating some technical strength and accumulation that could create that feedback loop that starts a new bull trend. So we'll see whether or not the bulls can start clearing some of these hurdles. So Eric, just on page 5, I have the weekly chart on crude. And what I wanted to do is set up context for what the type of trades that we're looking at setting up with the options trade is this idea that, well, you know, crude had this great run, but if there was going to be another move on the upside, the crude oil hitting $150 or even $190 on the upside, while it seems like a stretch, is not impossible. And certainly putting on some low-cost option trades to be playing that upside melt-up is an interesting way of putting it on without being loaded up on all sorts of Delta 1 positions at the money.
Patrick, that's exactly right. And the way I think about this is, you know, that blue arrow you've got, it's coming at some point. The question is whether there's a red arrow that's not drawn on page five that comes first, where we go down to $60 before we go up to $160. And of course, if you were just to buy crude oil futures hand over fist here, thinking, oh boy, 200-day moving average, this has got to be the bottom. You know, if you load up on them and then we go down another $20 from here, that could get really painful. So the question is, how do you structure the trade for maximum upside while minimizing your downside risk? Because let's face it, we do have a recession coming and it's going to result in some demand destruction. So I'm not sure what the next few months brings, but I think the blue arrow comes sooner or later and I don't want to miss it. So that's really what's on my mind. How do we put the trades on in order to not miss the blue arrow, but not be exposed to maybe another 10 or 20 bucks of downside, depending on what happens with the recession?
So, Eric, that was exactly what I was thinking in terms of putting on some different options trades. So what I did here was I just first put up some charts just to size up the crude oil markets in terms of the options. And then we can certainly take a look at what kind of combinations you could put on to put some of that upside gamma just in case the market did have a big rip. Now, on page six, I just have the January 2023 crude oil implied volatility. Just wanted to highlight that while volatility is high, when you look at relative to the average range that the implied volatility has been in the post-Ukraine period, we are trading towards the bottom end of this range. So right now, volatility has somewhat normalized. We're not getting these, you know, we're not going up in the 55-65% ranges where we have seen short-term spikes go up to. So right away, there isn't a crazy cost for buying upside gamma straight out, but I tend not to like to have that heavy of a theta burn just buying at the money calls. So this is where we can kind of talk about some of the different types of strategies you could put on to play that upside. Also, just on page seven, I will just put that implied volatility relative to its 30-day realized historical volatility. And you can see that while it is a rich vol premium, it's not that far from where the actual realized volatility has been. And so I think options right now in the crude oil market are very reasonably priced to be putting on all sorts of these types of strategies. The other thing that I highlight on page eight, which is the skew, what is interesting is that what you have, which is almost like a very typical equity style skew, that big fat left tail, right? So volatility premiums on put options are very expensive when you're going out of the money, particularly to $50 or less on the downside going for the rest of the year. But what is interesting is the skew stays relatively flat for any move in crude oil up even $30 before it starts to steepen upwards. And so there's lots of room to get very reasonable option premiums without paying up any big pickup on right tail upside until you start getting to some pretty high levels on the upside.
Patrick, let's talk about the different trading strategies. The most obvious one is just buying calls. But despite what you've said about implied volatility and realized volatility tracking reasonably close, they're still both really high. And that means you're paying a lot for those calls. Are there better strategies that we can use in order to get that upside without paying through the nose for volatility?
Eric, let's put some context to this. First of all, let's build a scenario. And the scenario is our hypothetical investor is already positioned in energy, whether directly through the futures contracts or whether through the equity markets, but they already have a certain amount of exposure. But what they're looking for is to put on a trade that if crude oil suddenly started ripping, some catalyst became evident and crude oil starts heading straight up, and we're suddenly heading all the way out to, you know, $120, $150. How do you put on some options trades that are incredibly low cost that under the circumstances, if that happen, have extraordinary payoffs? And yet with on balance of probabilities, if crude oil doesn't make that move, you don't lose a lot. You're just putting on some almost right tail insurance on a really big crude oil move. And so the strategies that typically reduce cost, the most traditional and basic strategy is a very clean and traditional debit spread, which is essentially buying a call option and simply choosing a higher strike call option to sell. What you're essentially doing is reducing your deltas, but reducing cost. Your theta burn goes down. You neutralize volatility risks, all sorts of different things. And you're making a very clean directional bet as to the upside move. So let's start with on page 10, I put up an options chain with $25 strike increments on the 159-day option going out into the new year. And what I wanted to do is basically think about the idea that, well, listen, what if crude just ripped and went to a fresh high? It was beating $125 on the upside, and you wanted to have some sort of a play with a debit spread on that crude oil will make a fresh new high this year and head towards 150. Well, you could right now open, let's say, a 125-150 bull call spread just over a dollar. And which pays off $25 if you're right about crude oil busting through the 150 level on the upside by the new year. And so you can immediately put on just a very modest cost debit spread and have the play that gives you a full participation if crude oil was to make that break to new highs.
Okay, Patrick, so in the debit spread or bull call spread scenario, what we're talking about is basically making a small bet that's going to have a big payoff, but that big payoff doesn't come until we get to $125 on crude oil price. So we've got to have a really big move up in order for it to pay off at all, but we're able to get that upside, $25 of potential upside, for about a dollar of cost. So this is the lottery ticket trade, I would think. What are the other ways of approaching this?
Well, I mean, there's lots of lottery ticket trades. In fact, this is where I want to talk about the ratio callback spread. And what I want to talk about here is the scenario where our investor that we're using as an example wants to buy an options trade or put on an options trade that gives them huge upside gamma if they're right about an explosive move in crude oil happening this year. And this strategy involves the selling of one closer at the money call. In this case, let's say we're going to use the January $100 strike call, which is trading just over $6. I'm rounding these numbers. And uses the proceeds of the $6 credit to buy the $125 strike call options, which are trading for roughly about $2 a call. And so you would buy three times as many of the call options with the credit. So you're out long that much more of the out of the money gamma. Now, this is a strategy that is done at a zero cost, but it doesn't have a zero cost carry. You have the margin being calculated very similar to a credit spread, where the spread between the two strikes has to be put aside as collateral. But from a cost perspective, this options trade is done at a zero cost. Now, this is one of these strategies where if you're a little bit right and crude oil goes up just a bit, you're going to lose some money. What you're looking for is that extraordinary right tail move where crude oil in this calendar year is going to be exploding north of $125 with some upside momentum. If that happens, this is one of these strategies that has all of that upside right tail open for you, and you make lots of money if there's that big explosive move. But if you're just a little bit right, that's where the danger zone is for this trade.
Well, Patrick, because of the recession that is oncoming, it's that danger zone that concerns me the most, because I think there is a scenario here, Patrick, where even in the face of recession, crude oil prices continue to drift slightly higher because more and more people figure out what David Hay and Adam Rosenzweig and I have already figured out, which is we're at the early stages of an energy crisis and it's going to get worse with time. But the thing is, until this recession plays out, we're going to continue to see decreasing demand. I think there's plenty of room to not go beyond 125 right away. And this trade really loses money significantly. If you get as far as 124, but not quite to 125, you've lost a few bucks. How about the butterfly spread? How does that one work?
Well, the butterfly spread is a very interesting way to have an alternative to the debit spread that has a really big payoff on the upside. And with the feature of the butterfly, very similar to the debit spread, is that the trade can be put on for just a debit. Like, you don't need to come up with any big heavy margin or anything. And so it's very low cost to buy that upside right tail insurance for an explosive move. Now, I want to give an extreme example of, let's say you believe that there was going to be an extraordinary move if some scenario happened. And even though your existing portfolio of long equities and crude oil plays and energy stocks was going to benefit, you wanted to have some sort of payoff that would be extraordinary if that big move happened. And so as an example, if you, let's say, did up to the end of the year, a butterfly spread between 150, 175, and 200, you can pretty much open that combination for 20 cents. Now, let me just step back and explain the butterfly. It is essentially, the easiest way to think about it is that it's a marrying a debit and a credit spread together, where you're short the 175 calls, but you're long the 150 and the 200 call. And this can be put on very cheap, like you're saying, 20 cents. And if for whatever reason, crude oil started ripping anywhere up towards 150 to 175, you could have that 20 cents turning into $25. But yet at the same time, if nothing happens, then you're only risking that 20 cent outlay. And so it allows you this opportunity to make some pretty big bets, or at least a big payoff bet, that if crude oil made that move, you can really get make a lot of money. And at the same time, your risk is defined to a very small, modest amount. And that is really sort of one of the ways that you want to buy right tail upside, because you don't want to have a big, heavy carry where you're theta burning a huge amount of option premium and it costs you a lot of money for a trade that might not work, right? Because if we look at it from a balance of probabilities, Eric, I mean, there's probably, I think the market is assigning somewhere like a 5% probability that we're going to go to 175 on the upside. So just based upon market pricing, there's a 95% chance that this option is not going to pay off and it's going to expire, right? And so you want to have a very low cost to it. And that way, if that really did arise and that big move did happen, you can make some really big money.
Well, Patrick, all three of these trade strategies are excellent food for thought. I will be considering them, as I'm sure will be many of our listeners. And folks, if you have enjoyed Patrick's analysis of option strategies, be sure to sign up for a free trial of Big Picture Trading so that you can get more of them every single day of the week with Patrick's webinars. You find the information on pages 11 and 12 of the chart deck, or you can just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Charlie's slide deck, as well as a chart book we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we're getting from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.